You're listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. For hundreds of ideas, free experiments and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. And now, here's your host, Ben Newsom.
Welcome to another Physics Ed Podcast. No matter where you are around this world of ours today, it's really worth your time as we hang out with Kate Kennedy-White, who's an accredited philosophy teacher-trainer in Australia and the United Kingdom. She helps teachers get students to think deeply about their world around them, very much so. She has done a lot of work presenting papers in Vancouver, Seattle, Cape Town, London, Auckland, Wellington, many other places. She has done a lot of work, and so much so, she was awarded the Outstanding Professional Service Award by the Institute for Educational Leadership in Australia for her voluntary work with Philosophy in Schools Association New South Wales. She understands how to help students to think, and today, that's exactly what we're going to learn about how to do it in your classroom too. So let's head on right over.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast. We're all about science, ed tech, and more. To see 100 fun free experiments you can do with your class, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled F-I-Z-Z-I-C-S. And click 100 free experiments.
Oh, look, I'm really looking forward to this. I mean, as I think about all the different episodes over the years with this particular thing, it's always been very topical. It's always been on a particular subject, but the work you do is rather broad. It really is.
Yes. I could spend a long time even defining the words, but, you know, I won't do that. That'll be too boring.
No. Well, that's it. Well, definitely it will not be. I know, because we hung out recently at a farewell for a good friend of ours. I know that the conversation's vibrant because the nature of what this is like. So there'd be some people, Kate, who haven't had a chance to meet you yet. So, Kate, could you let people know what you get up to?
What I get up to, well, at the moment I'm a teacher trainer at a private boys' school in Sydney, where I guess my what I am is a philosophy teacher for children. And this is a movement we can talk about in more depth in a minute. So I take classes of boys in this particular school, and they have a philosophy session with me once a fortnight, which is motivated by what they are thinking about and what they're wondering about and what they're curious about. Basically, the big concepts in life that are contestable or abstract that we all, struggle with all our lives, you know, not just what is the meaning of life, but any other question that fits into that philosophical questions. So that's what I do at the moment. I'm in a class. And then the secondary part of that is I'm training teachers to do this within their classrooms as well.
This is fantastic. What grade levels are you working with for this?
Kindergarten to year six. So kids from 5 to 12. And a lot of people go, how can kids do philosophy at 6 or 8 years old? Well, if you know anything about children, they're asking you why from the time they're two. You know, why does this happen? Why does that happen? That isn't fair, Dad. You know, all those things that you've had. And you know, is Father Christmas true? Are you telling the truth, Mum? You know, these are questions where really underpin the ideas of what is truth, what is reality, what is fairness. Kids ask these questions and then they come and nobody answers them. So philosophy with children gives the opportunity for children to ask the questions that matter to them.
When you talk about philosophy for children, I mean, I can kind of get the construct of what it might look like. But, I mean, a lot of us will have been exposed to philosophy in lots of different ways. Our different backgrounds sort of produce this image of what they think it might be. Mm-hmm. What is it really?
Okay. It's really interesting because it is really deeply philosophy in the Greek, in the Socratic way. And it emerged in America in the 60s, which was by a guy who was led by John Dewey as an educationalist, as you know. And it was really what Matthew Lipman discovered and Sharp, that graduates coming to the university in Columbia, in New York, were not able to say what they thought about anything. These are 18, 19-year-olds. So, you know, his hands in the air saying, you know, 12 years of school, and they don't have the confidence, they don't have the curiosity, they're not wondering about things. And so he went back into a school in New Jersey and started taking philosophy lessons with eight-year-olds. And what emerged from that is something we call philosophy for children. And it's very much a dialogic methodology So just to describe what the kids do in my class, they come into a room. It's a bespoke room which has no desks and no chairs. We sit on the floor in a circle, or we sit on little benches on circles, and we collaborate with each other, motivated by and or sort of stimulated by mostly a question that children ask. So today, as I told you earlier, you know, the big discussion was that somebody wasn't being fair in the playground, and we had to dissect the word fairness. And did fairness mean, was there a distinction between fair and equal? And is it necessary to even have fair? If nobody's fair, then what's the point of the word fair? These are the questions that eight-year-olds are asking. And that we talked for an hour, and then off they went. But they did reflect on the idea that maybe fairness wasn't as easy as saying, that's not fair, that's my chair, you're sitting on my chair.
What's interesting about this is I think about some of the conversations I have in a science classroom, whereby there's this assumption that a young child, because you're working with young kids, you're kindergarten, grade six, that a young child may not be able to grasp a complex topic, but often it's a language barrier. It's not necessarily the thought process. They get what they want to say, they just can't say it. Do you feel the same thing happens in the philosophy?
Well, a lot of people will say that. It's a very common thing. But in being in a classroom, and I'm in a classroom of year twos, what are they, seven, eight? They are very able to talk, yes, discuss. And then simultaneous with running this discussion, you know, I give them, they're asked to justify things. There are, first of all, there's the motivation to ask questions, to wonder, to interpret, to be curious. And that's just, wow, we can talk at last in school. You know, in fact, I've painted the walls of my classroom in chalk paint, and the kids, when they have this bursting question, get it, and they've said it out loud to me, and it's not a library question or it's not a factual question. It's an open-ended question, because they now know what an open-ended question is, one that needs discussing. So they can scroll it on the wall. And in fact, during a discussion today on fairness, one boy said, look, I've just noticed on the wall last term, some boy asked another question about fairness, but it's different to what we're asking, but it fits in with what we're asking. So they all talk about fairness and friendship and truth and, you know, things like that. So that's the first thing. But sorry, what I meant to do is that that's backed up by very explicit teaching of skills to give rigor to their thinking. So those skills at the very early age are justifying what you say with a quality reason, or it could be to make an inference about something. I teach inferences to year twos. I'm teaching, you know, a very basic form of logic right from year three, so that if the premise is true, and there's two premises that are true, the conclusion will be. And if there's no premise, then the conclusion is just an assumption or a generalization. And they use these words in the class. Mm. Even today, one boy will say, well, I'm going to disagree with Ben.
Yep.
Because when he said that, he wasn't thinking that's not always true. Therefore, his reason isn't justified. They'll speak like this.
That's awesome.
And it's a language that the language, and I don't back down from this. I'll say, I'm not clear what you're saying. And someone will say, well, give us an example. And that's really fantastic. And they go, in other words, I could give you a different example. And then some boy will say, and I can give you a counterexample to that. And this is their language. Just like in mathematics, they have a language. In philosophy, we have a language. And it's not fancy, you know. And, you know, it's interesting when I listen to politicians talk, and, you know, which politicians have actually done some really good thinking and training and which haven't. You know, someone will call for a distinction when somebody fumbles over two words that sound alike but actually mean something different. So there's a lot of support for the children to take them through this scaffold. So by the time they're in year six, I have an expectation in a variety of areas of an ability to have really good rigor, to identify when they're generalizing, you know, to question an assumption, to note that inferences could have many reasons, not just one. You observe something, and you'll know this from science. You infer something, therefore, or, you know, you see something happening, observe it. It doesn't necessarily mean that what you're inferring is the only answer. And they get it.
which is fantastic. Because I mean, that even just as you're saying, that just popped to my mind. Like one of the things that really keep in mind when we're doing science is correlation does not imply causation. It just doesn't. And there's some really fun examples. I mean, I'm going to struggle just off the top of my head here, but there was something like some ridiculous thing, like the number of murders in some state is correlated with the amount of cheese bought in the same state, or something ridiculous. some ridiculous numbers. It makes no difference, but the math works. It's kind of it's interesting to show those things to the kids.
Yeah. So that's what I do. And, you know, I'm training the teachers. I run training courses for teachers. That's the core of what I love to do the most. So, you know, we take courses. It's a 2-day introduction course that I'll run with another, some of the other people, nearly all of them I trained myself years ago, but I've been training 2 days where they are sort of equipped to understand what's this community of inquiry that we work in, because it's a collaboration between people. And what that develops, like if we're having a discussion, it automatically encourages an open-mindedness, because you can't have a collaboration if you don't listen to the other person. Even if you're going to disagree with them, you must listen to their reasons and understand. And even halfway through a lesson today, it was so lovely. A boy in year four, I made them sit in pairs to say, is there a distinction between fairness and equality? And this boy said, no, they're both exactly the same. And his little mate next to him said, well, I disagree with him because I think can be different. And they all give their reasons for distinctions. And halfway through the conversation, the first boy said, you know what, I've just changed my mind. This is what, you know, as teachers, we love to hear. I listened to him. I thought about what he said, and it made more sense than my argument.
Yeah, and yet we watch adults many a time. We find a hill to die on, don't we? With our ideas, it happens all the time.
I know it's not. So that, you know, I guess what I think is not what the critical thinking skills are, but how do you develop a critical thinker? So I'm focused on the boys, you know, to have this disposition to wonder, be curious, ask questions confidently, to have a sort of a disposition to be open-minded, you know, which are all the things that we would wish mature people would have. That these kids have it.
Which is interesting as I think about what it's like in the formal schooling world, saying, you know, we've got a curriculum, we've got hopefully a measurable output, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, just like you're talking about in the 60s, you're preparing kids for thinking into the university courses, even when they're young, to actually really, really think about how, you know, what is a good question? How do we follow reasoning? How do we question the reasoning? Is it valid? Is it not? How do you go about that, especially considering that you're setting this and getting it in motion in the current school that you're at? I mean, were there many barriers? Was it easy to set up? How's it all sort of go?
I was at a fantastic school that I set up. We called it the Philosophy School. It was in Bondi Public School, State School. And I had the support of a principal who really believed in this. And I had free hand. 600 kids every week came through that classroom with me.
Wow, that's busy.
Okay. And it was wonderful because, you know, I think, I don't know, I can't work out how many classes that were, that was. And the most of them came for an hour, but that in that school. But it wasn't, because I actually did some mapping against NAPLAN over 3 years to see what had happened. And maths and literature zoomed way up to that top level when it was below the line where it should have been in a school of that socioeconomic barrier. And this correlated, mine was just a tiny little me study, but it correlated precisely with studies that have been done all over the world. In England, 4,000 kids did philosophy, and they used a test on those children with another school that weren't doing it. And the correlation was amazing, the advances in the children's thinking, in their ability to confidently approach some problem solving. So they didn't need to regurgitate what the content was in the class, but to think it out for themselves. You show them, a map of the world, and, you know, and it might show the sort of vegetation of the world. And then look at it. What does it make you think? What could you deduce from what you're seeing? You know, be curious about it. What happens, though, that although I'm doing this philosophy as a sort of a standalone subject, one of the things I'm doing with the staff, and I've done it in other schools too, is make sure it's embedded within the subject areas.
Yeah.
So if we're doing oceans, which they were doing in year six a few weeks ago, you start looking at things like ownership, rights, cultural interpretations of the value, responsibilities. And if you start talking about these things, this lifts it up and above the content. Not to say the content isn't essential when you're studying anything, let's call it oceans, it's always my go-to word, but to consider that people have a different interpretation of what is the ocean. If you look at the Northern Indigenous people in Australia, and what they think the ocean is where the high water mark is in Thai. So therefore they own part of that. And then you have the Western view is the ocean belongs to everybody and nobody can own it. And, you know, so how do you discuss this conflict? It is a conflict between those two ways of thinking. And I don't know, it just makes it, and that's a really naff example of, I embed it very heavily into mathematics because in mathematics, it's a conceptual language. But what happens with kids, if you don't start talking about what is zero or what is infinity or what is a pattern, then you don't understand maths at that concept level and you suddenly hit the brick wall. Year four, year five, you can't do maths because you just didn't really get it, even as much as one of the symbols and signs and how they are, we make assumptions when we teach maths without stepping back going, well, what do the kids not know? So it's so if you allow them to ask the questions, you'll soon find out, you know, like, why then does a triangle like this always happen to be like this? And that you realize, well, this is fantastic that they'll talk maths in the classroom and they'll think mathematically in the classroom. So it goes across all subjects. So the training of teachers is really, I'm very keen to it, that it's embedded into the method. It's a methodology that you use in the classroom in whatever you're doing. You're reading a novel. You might be reading Fantastic Mr. Fox, but boy, there's some really big topics buried in there, you know, on justice and doubt and environmental rights and theft. There's all sorts of things buried that you can then deepen those discussions. So when the kids come to write about that novel or whatever, it's not comprehension questions they're getting, but, and it's not just defining the characters, it's deeper stuff that they can write about because it's, they've talked about it. You know, there's been a lot of talk in the classroom over not just Fantastic Mr. Fox, but about the issues that he obviously had to think about or lie about or whatever he had to do or survive about. And you see the writing is richer because it's the discussion on the big questions that the kids will in fact ask.
G'day, it's Ben here. I hope you're enjoying this particular chat. And guess what? There's so much more you can do with your science teaching. Head on over to physicseducation.com.au. There are complete and comprehensive teaching units that you can get your hands on. If you click on the top, you will find there are a whole bunch of scope and sequences, cross-curricular teaching ideas, hundreds of printable experiments and activities, videos, risk assessments, marking rubrics, you name it. It's all there and it's all linked to the curriculum and it's something that you can implement right now. Head on over to physicseducation.com.au and check out what's on offer.
Which I love. I mean, I think about people who are listening in this, with a lot of science and STEM practitioners in different forms listening to this, and STEM by its very nature is solving problems with things. So it's a lot of ways. So, and I think about what I've come across with students in different schools, how they define the problem, is it worth solving?
Yeah.
And it seems to me that, I mean, a lot of kids, I mean, I was one of them. It was a really young one. I was very keen, very, very keen to just get going. I just wanted to start. I wanted to rush ahead,
like
rush ahead, rush ahead.
Didn't you?
Yeah, totally. I was like, oh, that's the one thing. Let's go for it. And that pause is really needed, especially when we're about to embark on a very large build on a, you know, solving or something. If you're not solving the most critical problem, you're still at the periphery.
Yeah, because what's the point of doing it?
Yeah,
that's true. And people, it's a little bit, teachers are a little afraid to let go and let the children ask the questions. Mm. I mean, the other day, the STEM teacher at this school was doing anatomy. And the kids wanted to get into human organs and the trade of them and all that stuff.
Oh, really?
These are year five kid boys, you know that.
Right.
So, and she so lovely said, why don't you bring this question up in philosophy? You know, what do we own and what don't we? What rights do we have over our own body? You know, is it appropriate to charge money to the highest bidder for your kidneys, you know, so you can leave your family rich? I mean, they're issues that I didn't bring them up and neither did the STEM teacher. The kids bring them up. So why not talk about them?
Which is fantastic because I often think about transdisciplinary delivery. I mean, the idea often that you'll get to plenty of schools that very much silo. We're doing English now. We're doing English now. Now we're doing math. Now we're doing something. Now whatever we're doing. And yet that's not how the human brain works.
Not at all. Not at all. And, you know, we've got this interdisciplinary subject. We have the maths that we know and we've got the English. But we've now appointed in this school an interdisciplinary expert. And I've worked so closely with her writing, going through the program for term one, semester one, and looking what the kids are doing and thinking, well, where, you know, because it's not natural for the teachers to think like that I'm suggesting. But I remember that year one were doing paleontology and with the flash word as well. So I decided that we'd have a question of what do we know and what don't we know? Just that, so the little year ones love talking about what I know and what don't I know. And one little boy said, and what do we need not to know? You know, okay, what things don't we, I don't need to know when I'm going to die. You know, this is how they talk. So that we got to that, what do we, so how, what do we know? And then we went on to the dinosaurs and we found that, you know, and the big heaps of bones. And how can we absolutely sure that that's the way they were? If you join all those bones together, you know, maybe whatever. Now, this is just, of course, we know we can, but, you know, some kids say, so we really don't know. They could have been purple and pink for all we know, but we don't know that. We don't know everything about dinosaurs. Now, that's just, at a, you know, and I dread the science teachers hearing me talk like this, but what it was is the kids were curious enough to think a little more deeply about the, you know, fossils and what they tell us and what they don't tell us.
What I love about these questions, though, in the science classroom, doesn't matter whether they're really young ones or grade 12 students, if someone asks what might be perceived as a question that's not worth asking, which is ridiculous because all questions are worth asking, you can then actually go, well, righto, well, let's look at how they might know the coloration of a dinosaur. I mean, as you were talking, I was just thinking about one of the very first examples of a dinosaur, an iguanodon. So they find this thing in a coal pit in UK, and they think, because we're used to looking at rhinoceroses, that these little thumb spikes are actually on its nose.
Yeah.
In fact, you can go to a park and you can still see this four-legged creature. Yeah. Walking around that looks like a rhinoceros. And it wasn't. These spikes were on their thumbs. And so they had their preconceived notion of what they think a thing looks like. And they applied it. And these are adults of the day. And the reality is, as we talk with students, is that science is really just a body of work. It's just, here's what we currently know. And we're about to go into the future a bit further. That means as soon as we go into the future, that means we're now working in the unknown. And sometimes, occasionally, it goes against what we currently know.
Well, and that's how the great things have happened. In fact, I was just reading a paper last night on what philosophy does is allows the uncertainty.
And to be comfortable with it.
Well, to be comfortable with uncertainty is pretty important, isn't it?
Mm.
What did I write since? I wrote something down. But it's not like when the boys left today, I mean, this is not, wasn't the, my best lesson for sure. But I'm just thinking of it because it was just an hour ago. As I walked out, I asked each boy, you know, do you think now you know how to use the word fair in the playground? They're going, no way. It means too many different things in different contexts.
But, and then, okay, right. In the context of a STEM podcast, a fair test is the heart of scientific reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely being fair. So in other words, for those people listening in, like if you're going to measure the speed of something, all the other variables need to be rather controlled. Otherwise, you might be measuring something else.
Yes.
Fair testing is the heart of it. We make this big deal of what science is. And the reality is it's not actually that difficult apart from all the content that we have to suddenly learn. It's just keep everything the same, change one thing, measure the effect of that change, and keep everything else the same. That is a three-year degree in about two or three sentences, ishly. I mean, of course, we've got to learn all the content about what science is, but fair in this context is, were you testing something fairly? where you're making it unfair with something, with an experimental plot or something. And perhaps this might be put against what you're doing with your class this afternoon.
Mm. I mean, but I find, I don't know. I see my kids and they're quite good. They're adults now, but they're really good. What people will say, your kids are really creative thinkers. And I don't mean creative. They create, not in the creative arty create. Mm-hmm. And I think that we've just often gone back to what they call their first principles. And let's ask the really basic question first. What do we know? What don't we know? Or, you know, what can we know for sure? Or what doesn't matter that we don't know? I mean, these are the questions that children love to talk about. You know, when I visit my grandchildren, we'll sit around the table and they'll go, Grandma, can we have a philosophy chat over dinner? And it will be, okay, whatever you want, what do you want? And, you know, it's like, well, you know, Daddy the other day said, you know, and then we'll find the question. But it's a way of thinking. It's a deep way of thinking that comes from the child or from the student. And what would I say? It gives them the agency over the conversation. It's not us saying you're going to learn today this. I'm going to say it three times and then you'll know it at the end of the lesson. And you and I know that tomorrow they haven't learned a thing. But I just wanted to make reference, you know, to people not to freak out. Of course, content's important, but I always think content has to have some relationship to their prior knowledge or their experience. Otherwise, it just sits out there. So the questions that you would ask prior to doing a science experiment are critical.
Yeah. It makes me think about the schools that haven't embarked on this process yet that possibly would like to. So yeah. It's going to take a leap of faith in some ways. How would they go about that?
Well, you know, we run these training sessions on a needs basis. I've done quite a lot where I just go into a school for a day and do a whole of school PD. Or, and you mentioned you've been to Dubbo. You know, I was in Dubbo 3 weeks ago where they'd done a two-day course, but they wanted a third day just to ask a lot more questions before they put their final lesson in for the certificate. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful day of, yeah, it was just, I just went there for the day to Dubbo, you know, just helping the teachers. They got the theory of it, they thought, but they didn't know what would happen on a very practical day-to-day level on an hour-by-hour by 5 minute by 5 minutes. How would it look in the classroom? And it was a question of allowing the children to chat in a fairly controlled way. Controlled meaning one person's talking, everyone's listening. Someone else gets a chance to talk about what that person was or maybe a new idea that stretched into their head. But once you do this, what we call a community of inquiry, it's called, it's been probably around since Dewey, where kids collaborate. And it's very much based on the same methodology as the science inquiry, philosophical inquiry. In fact, the pattern is very much the same. And just so the answer is yes, you know, do a two-day intro course. And then, you know, we offer support to do it or observation or whatever. Whole of school or just send two or three teachers that have a bit of an interest in this. And what I want to say is it's not about having done philosophy at university. It's a way of thinking. We don't need to teach the philosophers. Although I had the joy once of having a mother who wanted to know about it. She had a PhD in philosophy. And at the end of each lesson, she had looked at me and she said, do you know they compared philosopher A with philosopher B? Okay, the kids were talking about Bondi Beach and the sand, but she said, but, you know, they brought up David Hume, but, you know, I didn't know and the kids didn't know and it didn't matter at that point. What mattered is that they just, you know, that they will bring up, well, we know, some of the things we know is that we know we're here because we wouldn't be able to think that if we didn't know, if we weren't here, which is Descartes. But I don't even mention those words to them. They don't need those words yet. I just want to answer their words.
Well, so think about this. There is a strong value in putting this in place in schools from getting kids to really be able to think really deeply about what they might be needing to do in all the different other subjects so they can be more efficient. I mean, there's an old quote, and this is the danger of quotes because you always misquote a quote and then sometimes they're misattributed as well. So I'm just going to say it and I don't care whether it's right or wrong, but the essence of the quote is still true. So there was one that was attributed to Abraham Lincoln and simply said, give me 6 hours to chop down a tree and I'll spend first 4 hours sharpening the axe. So it's efficiency, spending the time to think really deeply about a problem and looking at all the different machinations about what might be right, what might be true, what might be false, what are our assumptions, all those things. Knowing where we're really sitting within a problem is rather important before we try and embark on solving said problem. And it means we're going to be more efficient in the process. It seems to me that as I think about what might be happening as in the school where you're working with, whereby they're going into their science, their English, their math, and all these other different subjects for these kids, but they're still being now directed back to you to think deeper about a problem, which is fantastic.
I'd have to say that nearly half the teachers at the school I've trained since I've been here, so that they know what I'm talking about, which is why they've come and say, got this novel, I can't quite find the big question in it. Like, oh, come on, we'll sit down for 5 minutes, we'll find it. It's about hope, or it's about wants and needs, or it's about this. But just to go to your lovely tree example, I heard a quote, which I'll misquote. It says, in philosophy, you think twice. You think, and then you think again. And I thought that was a beautiful thing. And I say to the kids sometimes, that's what we do. We think, we chat, then we think again. And we've often changed our mind or changed our position or moved it a little bit or learned something to find that we don't know anything now.
And that can be applied in lots of ways. So even when you're writing out an email, stop, go have a coffee, have a tea, have a break, come back to that email, and maybe you might delete it rather than send it. Who knows? But thinking twice is rather useful in our own personal lives, let alone the subject areas.
Yeah, well, you know, philosophy goes right through life. You know, it's, and I find the value of it is being able to listen to a conversation where two people are banging against each other and saying, well, what are we really talking about here? Aren't we talking about the concept of ownership? And is there such a thing anyway? You know, just lift it away from the personal to the big concept and talk about that instead.
Which is where the fun is. This is awesome. Kate, thank you so much for hanging out with me this afternoon, especially when you had
second time I've hung out with you in my life. Ben.
It was good though. Doing this. I mean, I reckon there'd be other people who'd love to hang out with you further. I mean, so how might they get in touch? Because there'd be some people who'd love to know, righto, there's clearly a potential possibility in their world. How would they do that?
Okay, a couple of things. Via my email, which I can give to you for people to contact. I also have a website which I'm about to bring down, I think. It's my training website called Kinder Philosophy. Kinder in the Germanic word of the child, kinderphilosophy.net. And there's quite a bit up there still of, you know, what philosophy can do for your school, what the training sessions are, who I am. And in fact, my co-teacher is in fact a high school science teacher, Sally. You know Sally?
Yes, I do.
And Sally and I, and so I get an enormous amount of how to embed the theory of what I do into subject areas like maths and science and technology, so that I've learned as much from Sally as she's learned from me, and we team together sometimes to do that. So did I answer the question? See, I'm typical. I go off on a random excitement.
I think you very much did. And as usual, the links are in the show notes, so you can click to your heart's content and find out more.
You can put the Kinder Philosophy into that, their link, yeah.
No, look, absolutely.
Oh, cool. Are we done?
Well, no doubt next time we catch up, you will have had more conversations with these blossoming adults effectively.
Oh, just, you know, I have to say, and any teacher that's done the philosophy course, just as I said, it's a 2-day basic. There's lots more courses, but the 2-day basic for a teacher gets you into a different way of being in the classroom, not all the time, but allowing yourself to listen to the kids freely. But teachers will say, I just am so motivated by my teaching. It excites you to being in the classroom when you hear the children talk.
Yeah.
Which we think we hear them talk, but, you know, in classrooms with the pressure teachers are under, even in primary school, to get the curriculum done and ticked off, they say, I'd love to do it, but I don't have time. Well, have 20 minutes twice a week where you chat about something that they've raised. That's enough.
Yeah, that actually reminds me, before we close out this episode, that reminds me of a chat I had with someone who's very, very well, very well, very, very, very well, I'm going to say very many times, distance learning specialist. This is an incredibly very, very good person doing this. And he actually tracked student motivation during the start of COVID and through that time. It wasn't about the content. He bang on about his history teaching for sure. But he tracked what was working, what wasn't. And he was actually open enough for kids to actually physically give him a rating out of 10 per lesson. And that's pretty bold, right? Yes. Very bold. And he noticed a reduction in his score over several months. And what he discovered and was able to turn around was that during the COVID meltdown, he became so hyper-focused on getting the content out like a shovel. I've got to keep on doing it over and over and over. He'd forgotten that what actually made his classes hum prior to COVID, when he wasn't doing the distance learning stuff as well, he actually found that it's the hallway conversations and the chats, those 3-5 minutes while you're marking the role or whatever else you're doing, that were bridging connection with his students. And then the content flowed easier. He'd made the mistake, and he openly said so. He'd made the mistake that he was so busy trying to shovel his content out because he had to, because he felt, oh my gosh, you know, COVID. He'd missed the point, and the students were starting to disconnect from him, and he turned it around.
That's a brilliant, I mean, it's brilliant, the study, but it's a brilliant point to make, you know, to question yourself and evaluate yourself as a teacher on how much do I know about these kids? I was in a class once, and, you know, I was relieving, and I was observing the teacher, and she said, okay, good morning, boys, whatever, blah. Anyone got a question? And one boy said, yep. Did I want to say to you that last night my dog died? Yeah. Okay. Anyone got another question? Oh. Yeah. Right. You know, and I want to stop everything. We need to have a little chat here. Just about that. Let him talk a little bit more, and what's he doing, and how is he? But, you know, it was like I could build a whole day's lessons on that stuff.
Yeah.
And bet you still could have done, you know, we could have done stuff. Don't go there. But I love the truth that he found and the joy in listening to the kids and letting them talk.
Yeah, and being open to that feedback.
And I think, too, that kids talk less and less than maybe when you were a kid or when I was a kid, because we didn't have devices. We had a radio that was put on for the news, and then when the news was finished, we had dinner and the room was quiet. There was just the kids around the table talking to your parents. And, you know, that I don't know, we talked about all sorts of things. That was the 20 minutes a day talking.
Well, there's a couple of good friends of mine who know I have a very good chat with my son on the way to basketball every week. Travels with my little boy. So he just asks any random question. Inevitably, lately it's been space and the human body. And then his mind just blips off to somewhere else. And it's just, all right, let me just chat. And because you're stuck in traffic for 50 minutes, those conversations are rather broad. And they're important. I don't turn on the radio for good reason, because he just drifts.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And so do I, because of it. It keeps me on.
So do we, rambling like this.
No, absolutely. And speaking of which, so we should say adieu. But however, I'm sure we'll be catching up again soon. So again, I want to encourage people listening in, please reach out to Kate. The work that's been done with Philosophy with Children is ideal for a way of thinking. Thank you so much,
Ben. It was a pleasure.
We hope you've been enjoying the Physics Ed podcast. We love making science make sense. Why don't you book us for a science show or workshop in your school? If you're outside of Australia, you can connect with us via a virtual excursion. See our website for more.
So I hope you enjoyed that chat with Kate Kennelly-White. Did it get you thinking? It certainly did for me. It got me thinking about how could we really work with our students to get them to deeply understand the world around them before we head them off to go solve problems. Let's get them to solve the real problems that actually genuinely matter. Now, if you want to know a little bit more, definitely go over to the website, go to kinderphilosophy.com and learn about how you can get involved and reach out to Kate and find out a little bit more. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I certainly did. And as usual, there are more episodes coming up on this podcast. So you've been listening to me, Ben Newsom from Physics Education. This is the Physics Ed Podcast, and I hope to catch you another time.
You've been listening to another Physics Ed podcast. We're excited about science. Subscribe to us on iTunes to download the next episode as soon as it's released. And don't forget, for hundreds of ideas, free experiments, our new Be Amazing book and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled FIZZICS.
This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network.
N.net.au.